Hello, this is Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, December 13, 2018. Possible firing of tenured professor on tap. University of Illinois trustees could take the rare step of firing a tenured faculty member Friday at a special board meeting in Chicago. The agenda includes a resolution and decision for dismissal of professor pursuant to Article 10 of the university statutes. The provision governing tenure for academic staff members, which allows dismissal and revocation of tenure for due cause. The identity of the professor and other details about the case were not provided, and U of I spokesman Tom Hardy and others refused to give the reason for the dismissal or the department involved. Professor Mark Steinberg, chairman of the Urbana Campus Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, which considers faculty discipline cases, said he couldn't talk about the case until after the board's vote on Friday. The university has been considering the case for a long time, including many parties, CAFT included. I have been advised that once the board makes a decision, that will be public. I assume they will summarize the particulars and the process, he wrote in an email from London, where he is attending a conference. The board held a five-hour closed-door meeting in Chicago on November 16th, citing the university employment or appointment-related matters exemption in the Illinois Open Meetings Act, but Hardy wouldn't say whether that was part of the dismissal proceedings. We don't talk about executive sessions, Hardy said Wednesday. The case does not appear to be connected to this recent sexual misconduct case at the College of Law. Hardy said he wasn't aware of any pushback on this case from the American Association of University Professors, which advocates for faculty due process rights. Harry Hilton, president of the campus AAUP chapter, said Wednesday his group wasn't familiar with it, but said most cases are kept confidential unless the person involved contacts the group. This is only the second faculty dismissal case to come before the Board of Trustees since the 1960s. Tenure is awarded selectively, and it is relatively rare for situations to emerge at which revocation of tenure is considered, Hardy said. Criteria for dismissal. Under university statutes, due cause for dismissal or removal of tenure exists only if one of three conditions is met. The faculty member has been grossly neglectful of or grossly inefficient in performing his or her university duties. His or her work performance or outside conduct demonstrates clearly and convincingly that he or she can no longer be relied on to perform those duties in a manner consonant with professional standards of competence and responsibility. Or if the faculty member has, while a university employee, illegally advocated the overthrow of our constitutional form of government by force or violence. The president can file dismissal charges against an employee with the Academic Senate after consultation with the Faculty Advisory Committee. A faculty member is then entitled to a hearing before the Campus Senate's Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure with an advisor present. The committee's findings and recommendations are forwarded to trustees, or if it recommends changes be dropped and the president concurs, the case is closed. If the committee recommends dismissal, or if the president disagrees with the committee's findings against dismissal, the president can forward the case to trustees. The employee then has the right to request a hearing before the board takes action. Most tenure dismissal cases are settled quietly before reaching the president or trustees. Prior terminations. In the 1960s, Leo Koch, an assistant professor of biology, was fired by trustees after he advocated for premarital sex in a letter to the Daily Illini student newspaper. After the U of I fired Koch, the AAUP censured the university for what it said was a lack of due process. And in 2013, after a lengthy hearing, U of I trustees voted to fire controversial engineering professor Lou Wozniak and revoke his tenure. Wozniak had been on the U of I faculty for 50 years and won several teaching awards, but also had a history of dust-ups with administrators. He hadn't taught since 2010 because of a dispute over a teaching award he believed should have gone to him. Among other allegations, administrators claimed that he disclosed a student's grade to others and sought student support for his grievance, videotaped students without written consent, appeared before a class after he was suspended from teaching, and violated university policy by sending an email message to students in which he said students should remind him of their names, because I only remember the names of GKs I've had sex with, referring to the students as grandkids. Wozniak's letter apologized to students and said the joke was in bad taste. The Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure concluded that although Wozniak behaved inappropriately, he should not be fired, saying a previous suspension by his department was sufficient. But it imposed certain conditions, such as refraining from talking to students about the award or publishing student information. In seeking dismissal, the university claimed Wozniak did not follow those conditions, which he disputed. Legal maneuvers. Friday's meeting is scheduled to start at 3 p.m. and will be webcast live at media.uillinois.edu. The agenda also includes a Juris Doctor degree for the new UIC John Marshall Law School in Chicago. U of I trustees approved the plan in July to acquire John Marshall, a private law school in downtown Chicago, authorizing Chancellor Michael Emeritus to negotiate a transfer agreement. The acquisition would take effect in fall 2019, creating Chicago's first public law school. John Marshall would transfer its students, faculty, assets, and degree programs to the university over 5 years. The Illinois Board of Higher Education approved the acquisition on December 4th, and the American Bar Association also has signed off. Approval is still required from the Higher Learning Commission, an accrediting body, and U.S. Department of Education, said UIC spokeswoman Sherry McGinnis. If all goes according to schedule, the first class of students will enter the merged law school in fall 2019. And here's a sidebar to this story. Possible gifts on trustees' agenda. Christmas could come early for Illini coaches set to get raises or contract extensions at Friday's special meeting of the University of Illinois Board of Trustees in Chicago. Besides Lovie Smith's 2-year contract extension announced last month, here are a few highlights. Volleyball coach Chris Thomas is slated for a salary bump and a 2-year contract extension after taking his team to the Final Four and perhaps beyond. Thomas earned $310,000 this year plus $8,000 car allowance. Under the new 5-year agreement, he'll be paid $340,000 next year and $10,000 more each succeeding year, topping out at $380,000 in 2023, according to athletic spokesman Kent Brown. His two assistants will also get 1-year contract extensions, with Alfred Reft earning $95,200 next year and Rashida Reed making about $92,300. Rod Smith will get a whopping $200,000 raise after his first year as football's offensive coordinator, earning $700,000 next year and $750,000 in 2020 under his proposed contract extension. Smith now earns $500,000. His new salary puts him just inside the top half of the Big Ten, according to Brown. All 7 full-time assistants plus head strength coach Joe Bowes will get 1-year extensions through January 31, 2021 to keep them on 2-year contracts, Brown said. A few salaries were adjusted to retain coaches who had been offered other jobs, he said. The football staff still has 2 vacancies, including a defensive coordinator to replace Hardy Nickerson, who resigned mid-season. Mum's still the word on the details of Lovie Smith's contract extension. He is in year 3 of his original 6-year contract, and athletic director Josh Whitman announced in November that 2 years would be added, taking Smith through January 31, 2024. Brown said his salary will remain at $4 million, but other details of the extension, including whether his buyout provisions would change, won't be released until the board votes, Brown said. If Illinois had fired Smith this year, it would have cost the school $12 million. The buyout drops to $4 million at the end of the 2019 season and $2 million the following year. Morelle Potner, a life remembered. She was a light in this community. Despite her illness, young woman praised as always being there for others. St. Joseph. Through the good times and the trying ones, Morelle Potner remained the same spunky kid who could brighten your day no matter how hers was going. There are always people in your life that when you think of them, you smile, said Terry Raine, one of her high school cross-country coaches at St. Joseph Ogden. That is Murrell. A 2017 St. Joe Ogden graduate, Miss Plotner, 19, died last week at St. Louis Children's Hospital, where she spent many nights since being diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, a rare blood cancer, as an eighth grader. But that didn't keep her from being the best teammate Alyssa Pridemore could ever ask for. Nor did what came in the years that followed, said Pridemore, who got to know Miss Plotner while the two were in middle school. Not even chemo, a double lung transplant, or several bone marrow transplants stopped her from being the best cheerleader and biggest fan for the running community, Pridemore said. I have never seen a stronger person, a more positive person, and never a person so willing to fight, Raine added. The image the coach will be thinking of when Miss Plotner is memorialized Friday at St. Joseph's Freeze Funeral Home is from November 5, 2016. That's the day the Spartans cross-country team wrapped up their undefeated season, winning the Class 1A title in Charleston. And then came team picture time. I remember handing her the trophy, Raine said with a laugh. And it was bigger than she was. What she lacked in size, the coach said, Miss Plotner made up in everything else. She was a light in this community, and she stood for strength, Raine said. Friends, teammates, and coaches marveled at her strength as Miss Plotner battled one major medical obstacle after another. First a bone marrow transplant, and then after she was diagnosed with graft versus host disease, a double lung transplant. She spent her eighth grade promotion in St. Louis Hospital for their first transplant, and last year's high school graduation ceremony recovering from a 12-hour surgery to get her new lungs. And in between, community members say she'll be the one trying to lift the spirits of anyone she encountered. Here's Suzanne Ford, SJO class of 2011. That little spunky fifth grader at cross-country practice made such an impression on me because she was kind and 100% herself no matter what. She was a friend to anyone who needed it, even while going through more in her short life than most people can begin to imagine. Even while she went through bone marrow transplants, fighting cancer, and a double lung transplant, I would often receive encouraging texts, tweets, and messages where she would encourage me through vet school and remind me I was loved when I was down. Here's her former English teacher, Leslie Ellis, who remembers showing up at the house to work with Ms. Plotner while she was sick and being greeted the same way every time, with a cup of hot tea waiting for her, just the way she liked it. This was her style. No matter her circumstance, she was selfless, thoughtful, generous, kind, gracious, and optimistic. And Deborah Studenars, who held multiple fundraisers for Miss Plotner in recent years, said cancer affects so many people, but not that many people affect others the way she did. I told her the cancer may have brought life to her gift, but not to ever forget that it was her, that she was reason for all of it, and there's a difference. Miss Plotner never gave up hope, said family friend Mary Doreen, knowing that Doreen and her family used to put on an annual fundraiser for St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Miss Plotner asked if she'd hold one for St. Louis Children's Hospital, where the young student was receiving treatment at the time. There was just one stipulation. Miss Plotner wanted it to be for the hospital, not for herself. She told me there's kids up there worse than me, Mary Doreen said. So for the past several years, the Doreens would host the fundraiser, then ask Miss Plotner to deliver the check. Said Doreen she would thank us every single time. Downtown Development, CoFusion owner bought PNC Building. The owner of the CoFusion Restaurants has bought the PNC Bank Building in downtown Champaign, a holding company that Janet Boobin manages, completed the sale last week for $2.73 million, according to county property transaction records. Boobin declined to share her plans for the building, which PNC plans to leave in January once it moves to the new Midtown Plaza development at 302 South 1st Street, Champaign. Boobin owns two CoFusion sushi restaurant locations, the first in downtown Champaign, opened in 2005, and the second opened in 2013 just south of Cranert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. She also remodeled the 1920-era's White Line Laundry Building at 723 South Neal in 2010 and bought the former News Gazette Building at 48 East Main Street, Champaign, in January 2017 for $1.77 million. There, Boubin is planning a project that's a mix of retail, restaurant, and apartments, though there have been no signs of work on that. The future has been uncertain for the 109-year-old bank building since PNC posted a legal notice in the News Gazette in June that signaled its intention to relocate. The bank was seeking permissions for the move from federal regulators, which was granted in August. The building was then put up for auction, but the buyers weren't announced. The transaction closed December 4th, according to county records, and Zach Weatherall, a broker with Coldwell Banker Commercial Devonshire Realty, represented the buyer, according to a tweet from Coldwell Banker. PNC told customers earlier this year that the downtown branch's last day will be January 18th, and the new one will open January 22nd. In a letter to customers, PNC market manager Andrew Baker said it chose to move the branch after it studied the effectiveness of our branches based on their physical capacity, as well as the number of customers who frequent each location, suggesting that traffic to the downtown building had declined. PNC was the first tenant to be announced in the new Midtown Plaza, a project by the Boneyard Creek Retention Ponds by developer Dan Hammelberg. PNC will be joined by the new brick-and-mortar location for the taco truck Fernando's and potential another restaurant. We've got more lookers, but it's a little premature to share that, Hammelberg said. We've got a large restaurant organization who is looking to put a cafeteria-style thing in here with also a cooking center. He said there's been interest from a barber and a beauty shop and a gym. We've got people circling, and we're happy for someone to land, he said, expecting more deals will be made after New Year's. The upper floors of the development are apartments that opened this fall and are fully leased, Hammelberg said. We have Jim Dye's column. Cliffhanger likely on the way to court here. That's some sheriff's race in Macon County, where the winner's one-vote victory margin has laid the groundwork for a possible recount and a legal battle over whether and how to do it. Before it's all over, the recount question may end up on the desk of Champaign County Presiding Judge Tom DeFonis, because the dispute is too hot to handle in Macon. DeFonis acknowledged that this lawsuit, once it's filed, would come his way. I handle all the conflict matters for Macon County, he said. Meanwhile, Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott has bowed out of the legal maneuvering. He asked Macon County Circuit Judge A.G. Weber to appoint a special prosecutor to provide any needed legal advice. Weber agreed to do so, and he requested that Attorney General Lisa Madigan's office step in. A spokeswoman for the Attorney General acknowledged that their office provided the county clerk with some election advice, but indicated it sees no other role for itself in the dispute over a possible court-ordered recount. That leaves the two candidates, Democrat Tony Brown and Republican Jim Root, to fight it out again, this time in a court of law rather than a court of public opinion. And if that's not enough, there's also a mystery. What about two uncounted ballots discovered too late to make the loser a winner? Outgoing county clerk Steve Bean acknowledges that he intended to recount two disputed ballots. They were misfed into the counting machine, but simply forgot about them until after the final results were certified. There's a lot here to digest, so let's begin at the beginning. Brown won the election by the slimmest possible margin, 19,655 to 19,654 over Root. At the time of the election, both were lieutenants in the sheriff's office. Brown has since been sworn in as sheriff. As far as he's concerned, the election is over. Until the court says otherwise, he's correct. But Root has other ideas. He wants a full recount. On election night, it appeared as if Root had eked out a victory over Brown. Root held a 99-vote margin, but his plus 99 fell to a minus 1 after mail-in and provisional ballots were counted November 20th. To lay the legal foundation for a full recount, Republicans sought a partial discovery recount. Up to 25% of the county's 72 precincts, 18, to search for evidence that would justify a court order for a full recount of all 72 precincts. What they discovered was a combination of the mysterious and the amazing. Two uncounted ballots from Hickory Point Precinct 1, both were for Root. Those two ballots, if counted, would give the Republicans a one-vote victory, and Root moved quickly to take advantage of the discovery. On December 2nd, he wrote new Macon County Clerk Josh Tanner, a Republican, to request a correction of the discrepancy and declaration of himself as the winner. 5 days later, Tanner replied that after consulting with the Attorney General's office, I have been advised that I lack the authority to declare you the winner of the Macon County Sheriff's race. Meanwhile, the discovery recount, which was suspended after the discovery of two disputed ballots, is expected to be completed Monday. Root's lawyer, Gerald Stock of Decatur, said we think we can move 5 votes to Root in a 3-precinct election contest. What's astounding is that the closeness of the election has compromised the machine's ability to count the votes. Stock said that machine recounts and the discovery recount produce different results than the election day numbers. That's what happens when the machine's margin of error rate exceeds the election margin, 1 vote. Stock said after the discovery recount is complete, a lawsuit seeking a full recount will be filed, and that it might include some or all of the county's precincts. The type of legal relief we request is still subject to decision-making, he said. What the Root campaign shows the court as evidence and requests as a solution will have a significant impact on how the Brown campaign responds. Ultimately, it's going to cost a lot of money, anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 for the recount, to be paid by the challenging party on top of legal fees for both candidates. Stock said that neither Republicans nor Democrats want this case to linger, but that civil litigation can take on a life of its own. Urbana Fire Department. UFD's Certifiability, a Class 1 Act. The fire department's earning a Class 1 rating from the Insurance Services Office is the dream. The inspections are so rigorous that this year just 305 of the more than 46,000 departments certified by the agency across the country earned that designation. Only 16 of them are in Illinois, and Champaign County now has 2, as the Urbana Fire Department has joined its sister agency across Wright Street in the exclusive Class 1 Club. To get this designation is a reflection of the quality of the department, the personnel, the education and the training, the facilities, the equipment, Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin said. It's a wonderful achievement that reflects a lot of hard work, and I don't know how often it happens to have 2 Class 1 fire departments in the same community, but I don't think it's very often. The project to bump Urbana's department up from Class 2 and reach the top 1% of all fire departments in the country started with former Chief Brian Neitlinger, though he said Captain Brian Huska did a lot of the heavy lifting. It wasn't just the half dozen of us officers who were measuring stuff. It was all 60 employees, Huska said. It's based on what we do on a daily basis, and we really think didn't change anything. I think we can say that across the board, Twin City residents are pretty well served. They're getting value for their tax dollars. Though full of confidence, Urbana's department wasn't in for an easy inspection. In calculating its public protection rating, the ISO looks at 4 factors: the fire department, the needed fire flow, the amount of water an engine needs to put out a fire, water supply and distribution, and emergency communications. So it's not just the fire department that gets scrutinized with a fine-tooth comb every year, but also METCAD and Illinois American Water. The ISO grades communities on a 100-point scale, and anything above 90 earns a Class 1 rating. Urbana got a 90.92 this year, with the fire department scoring 45.02 out of 50, Illinois American Water scoring 36.65 out of 40, and METCAD scoring 9.55 out of 10. That 9.55 score elated METCAD Director Ralph Caldwell. Obviously, it's stressful because our evaluation impacts other organizations, not just MedCAD, Caldwell said. But we pride ourselves in doing the right thing at the right time and meeting their guidelines to get first responders to the scene quickly. We scored very high, but couldn't have done it without everyone else. We're one family, we're brothers and sisters. Operations manager Betsy Smith was most proud that now both fire departments and CU are certified at the top of their game. It really speaks to the cooperation between the two departments, Ms. said. They do a lot of training together and a lot of mutual aid together. Matt White, superintendent of the distribution system of the Illinois American Water, said that rating is proof that the effort that all three organizations have been putting in is working. It was my first time going through the rating process. Excuse me. So, of course, not knowing what to expect, we made sure we had all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, White said. But I can't say it was a huge surprise. We did our homework and it all worked out well together. That is proof that we're all working together to make sure we take care of the people in our community. Urbana Fire Lieutenant Greg Kingston said he feels very lucky to finally, officially be on the same level as the department next door. Not many get this rating, so it shows we're doing the work we need to do, Kingston said. We're very fortunate to have a community right next door that when our resources are taxed, we have a comparable, equally trained and competent fire departments. Urbana's new fire chief called the rating monumental. The work this department has done is tremendous, Chuck Loss said. I know before I ever started that this department works very, very hard, and they're very committed. This ISO 1 is a perfect indication of how good the department is and how well they serve the community. It's awesome to be a part of it. The health reporter is in. What's the possibility that women under anesthesia at local hospitals could be getting unauthorized pelvic exams by medical students and not know it? Illinois law requires any medical provider, doctor, medical student, resident, nurse, advanced practice nurse, or a physician assistant, to inform a patient of his or her profession upon providing the care, which includes but is not limited to any physical examination, such as pelvic examination. In the case of an unconscious patient, state law requires any care or treatment administered to be related to the patient's illness, condition, or disease. Carl Foundation Hospital and OSF Healthcare emailed statements to the News Gazette media about their positions on this issue, but declined to be interviewed. At OSF Healthcare, the privacy and dignity of our patients is of utmost importance, said Dr. John Kreckman, Chief Medical Officer and VP of Medical Affairs. OSF Healthcare providers do not perform exams or procedures without a patient's consent. Carl said health and safety of its patients is its top priority, and it helps patients understand their rights in many situations, including while they're under anesthesia. The statement goes on to say Carl Care teams do not perform additional procedures or tests other than what the patient agrees to for teaching or any other reasons. With the exception of dealing with an unexpected medical situation, the care team can address while working through the original need or needs, the patient is aware ahead of time what the team will do. U of I Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson said Illinois is one of six states that forbid unauthorized medical exams, but she doesn't see Illinois law alone providing adequate protection against this practice. For one thing, she said, laws don't necessarily equal a social movement. And in the absence of disclosure, unconscious patients aren't in a position to know when they're being examined by doctors in training and or for something unrelated to their conditions, unless a friend or family member actually observes it, she said. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, December 13th, 2018. Please stay tuned for Part 2.